I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this day before Thanksgiving, November 27, and it seems a perfect day to talk about what we're going to discuss this hour. Edward S. Curtis and the Vanishing Race. It's currently at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend, and it is so worth seeing. I was just captivated by this exhibition. Curtis dedicated 30 years of his life to taking tens of thousands, something like 45 to 50,000 photographs of what he thought was vanishing, and he was right, Native American life in the Northwest and the Southwest. This is the first major exhibition of his work in his home state of Wisconsin in more than a decade, and he was born near Whitewater. We will hear about his life. The director of the museum, Lori Winter, is with us, longtime friend of ours, and she says that with the opening of the new building, in West Bend, they made a commitment to feature on a more regular basis some of Wisconsin's oldest art, that of Native American tribes. A little bit later, we will be speaking with a filmmaker, and as part of this exhibition at the Museum of Wisconsin Art, this film will be shown next Thursday evening. It's a perfect way to spend an evening, as far as I'm concerned, and I hope you think so as well. The film is Coming to Light, the Edward S. Curtis story. So that's coming up at the museum. Well, welcome phone calls. Some of you, I'm sure, have had a chance to see this exhibit, or you may know, and I must admit, I didn't know very much about him at all. You may know something about Edward Curtis because he's a fairly well-known guy. Hello, Lori. Thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon. I'm happy to be here, and happy Thanksgiving to everyone out there.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving to you. I love Thanksgiving. It seemed a good time to do this show. It's a good thing to do over this weekend. I really didn't know much about Curtis and his work. The breadth of his work is just astounding, isn't it?
It is. It's almost a 40-year odyssey of work. And so we have some photographs from as early as 1896 through the mid-1930s. And it was a life commitment to record and document what he viewed was the vanishing race of Native American cultures in the United States. And he was quite interesting in that he realized very early on that the many tribes throughout the United States were very distinct. We tend to think, and it certainly is a misconception, we tend to think that all Indians live in wigwams or teepees, they ride horses, they wear feathered headdresses. And he realized that nothing could be further from the truth, that these cultures had great variety, that some of the tribes were small. And in some areas, particularly in California, the tribes were treated with utter brutality by white settlers. And he feared that they were disappearing. He took it on as a personal commitment and obligation to record their culture before they vanished.
Now, you have how many of the photographs? 45, 50 of them in the exhibit?
We have 45 in the exhibition. Graham Reed, our director of exhibitions and collections, and I personally selected them. We tried to pick a wide variety. So landscapes, portraits, including even the famous portrait of Geronimo, photographs showing young teenagers within the tribes, domestic and arts and craft. It was a daunting task. There are over 40,000 extant photographs, and we wanted to show the very best and also a grouping of works that showed the rich variety over the period of 40 years.
The ones that really struck me are the portraits. And I guess he was a portrait photographer early on, too, wasn't he? Would you say that's the bulk of the work? Because you are familiar with probably all 45 to 50,000.
Yes, absolutely.
Or was it half portraits, half country?
No, I would say that it is equally divided between portrait, landscape, including figures, and genre, sort of domestic setting, and because he really wanted to show the totality of life But he also wanted to show and recognize leaders within the tribal communities. So in some ways, I do agree with you that those are the some of the most moving, because they tend to be quarter length, bus length, or half length. And it is this kind of frontal confrontation. I mean, think of photography at 1906, you know, where the sitter had to hold still for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. It's not like flash photography today. And so there is a kind of kind of monumental quality to the photographs, that the sitter is posing front on in an almost kind of confrontational way with the viewer. And some of them are dressed in what I would say is a full period dress of the period. And so you see that kind of elaborate outfitting for these photographs as they sat there, I think, in some respect, with pride. Mm-hmm. And trust. Trust is probably the key word. Curtis developed a relationship with his sitters. And, you know, imagine this white man coming in with a contraption of a box and camera.
Really? I know.
Doing these photographs, it must have been a little daunting, maybe even a little frightening. And he built a relationship with them, a relationship based on trust.
And they're not black and white photos. Tell me the process. They're more brown. What is that process?
Yeah, they have a beautiful – they're called photogravures. Hmm. And they are the glass technique, or the photographic technique, is based on glass. So it's a photographic technique early in the 20th century, before Kodachrome, based on producing an image on glass. That image is then etched from the glass plate.
Oh.
So it is a combination, yeah, in this early kind of mix of technology. It's a combination between an etching and a photograph. Before we moved into the 20th century, in which we understand photographs today. So they tend to be a kind of warm sepia tone. And unfortunately, there's a longer story, and Anne Makepeace may comment on this, so I'll leave that to her. But there's a point where Curtis's daughter destroys many of the almost all of the glass plates, which was part of a kind of ugly divorce settlement, and Anne can speak better than I can to that. So unfortunately, a lot of the original glass plates, which were used for the printing, were shattered.
Was he unique, or were there a lot of artists who were doing this combination of etching glass work?
Yeah, it was fairly short-lived, actually, at the turn of the century, probably two decades to three decades in sort of longevity. I mean, they moved to a much quicker process as soon as it became available. I think he liked the sepia tone, and that because it had an earthy quality, and that color, just the palette choice, the color choice, really fit his subject matter, and it connects the figures, the setting to the land, to the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And in some respects, it's that choice that contributes to the success of the photographic image.
And when you think about how difficult it was to travel to all of these tribes with this heavy equipment by trains and sometimes by horses. He was on horses.
Donkey and wagon.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh. What a job that was to do this body of work.
Yeah. He tells us, there's one in his writing, he tells the story of one moment where he's on a precipice and, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, he's by himself, and, you know, the donkey and the cart, you know, tip, and everything that's on the cart goes, you know, roughly a mile downhill. And so then he had, you know, his camera was shattered. Here he was out in the middle of nowhere. It took him, as he said, 12 hours just to, you know, patch the camera back together so that he could continue to make photographs. He was actually quite lucky that it wasn't completely destroyed. So he's an interesting character. He went into areas that were trackless, that had no Western sort of white visitors, and went into places where trains hadn't gone yet. And I think he photographed something like 80 or 81 separate tribes. And so we tend to think of him as being in the Southwest, but he was also in the Northeast, in Seattle, photographing the tribes in that area, and then even into Alaska, photographing the Eskimo people.
Yeah, I really love the Eskimo paintings. There's something different about them, the photos. There's a serenity and almost a happiness before they're massacred as well. The other thing that's amazing about his story, Lori, tell me how this happens in the art world, is here's this guy who is fairly prominent. I mean, he knows some big shots, J.P. Morgan and Teddy Roosevelt, and they kind of help him along. And then his work disappears. How can anything like this disappear for 40 years? How does that happen?
He certainly was fearless. I mean, once he decided to do the project, he travels by train to New York, and he starts knocking on doors. He somehow manages to get an interview with Morgan, the great financier. Morgan was about to shove him out the door, and suddenly Curtis had his wits about him and just started showing him images, and the images are so captivating that Morgan completely changed his mind, just based on a handful of images. That gives you a sense of their power. And so he ended up funding about 50% of the project, and it was a project to create 20 volumes of the Native American tribes, and 40,000 photographs. He ran out of money after only about 6 years, but continued the project and tried to scrape and piece the money together as best he could. What ended up happening is that he ended up personally financing it until he ran out of money and started building debt and so forth, but still somehow continued. So it was a great sort of personal fervor that made the project happen.
And then it was lost. It was sold, was it, or something, to a Boston bookstore, and then we'll talk about this with the filmmaker, found in the basement.
Well, there were patrons who purchased the 20 volumes, and those ended up on back shelves in libraries and so forth, and you have to keep in mind the time period. Many of the volumes were completed before 1920, and then the Great Depression hits. And it's from 1900 to 1920, there was a fascination with the West. It was being settled. People were intrigued by it. People were interested in the diversity of the Native American tribes, and so he was capturing that, creating this glimpse, and so he was able to sell his photographs to magazines that were reproducing them. He even went to Carnegie Hall and did a lantern slideshow accompanied by music of these great images, and he was received with a standing ovation at Carnegie Hall. So there was a fascination, and then the Depression hit, and that drove everyone into their homes. And so there was a less interest in what other people were doing. Expansion westward drew to a screeching halt. And people were just worried about putting food on their table. And as a consequence, there was less interest in the Native American tribes. And by the 40s and 50s, as America began to recover economically, there was a different view of Native American tribes. They, probably in some respects a good way, there wasn't the kind of fascination with the oddity of Native American tribes. And they had become part of the weave of American culture. And so at some point, a large quantity of the images were purchased by a book dealer, And it was in, I think, 1972 that someone visiting the basement of the book dealer said, you know, these aren't bad.
These aren't bad.
And so they started to resurface.
Oh, my.
And there were a couple of exhibitions in, I think, the mid-'80s, the early 90s, one at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and maybe another exhibition after that. And so those were the kind of first revivals of this work.
Hmm.
It had simply fallen out of popularity.
Yeah. And this is the first, what, in a decade, major exhibition of his work in our state,
oh,
which is
sure.
his home state.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is the first major exhibition of his work in our home state.
Hmm. Laurie is with us this hour, and later we'll be joined by a filmmaker who's done a really lovely work on Curtis as well. Some of you, I hope you've had a chance to see the exhibit and were interested in hearing your response to it. It's at the Wisconsin Museum of Art through January 5. Curtis Edward S. Curtis, born in Whitewater, very near Whitewater in 1868, documented the lives, traditions of 80 tribes in various parts of the United States, and 45 of those are on display, and they're really worth seeing. They're very, very striking, memorable. They just stay with you. So here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Edward S. Curtis and the Vanishing Race is on view now through January 5 at the Museum of Wisconsin Art. The executive director of that museum, Laurie Winters, is with us now, and later filmmaker Anne Makepeace, whose film Coming to Light, Edward S. Curtis and the North American, or Coming to Light, the Edward S. Curtis story will be shown December 5 at the museum. So we'll go to you in just a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Oh, and we also want to remind you that KP this afternoon put about 10 of the photos from the exhibit on our website, on our Facebook page, so that you can get an idea of what we're talking about. So listen to us and then look at the pictures at the same time, and you'll have an enhanced experience this afternoon. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Laurie Winters is with us, and we are taking phone calls for her. Claire in Madison, our first caller. Laurie, hi, Claire.
Hi,
Claire.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I have not seen this exhibition yet, but I'm definitely going to make a trip to West Bend to see it, because I am familiar with Curtis photos. I even have a few myself. They are magnificent.
Wow.
But my question is, since Laurie mentioned that almost all of his plates were destroyed, how did they get the photos for their exhibit? Are they originals, or
yes,
where did they come from?
They're original photogravures, and there are three museums in the United States that have the complete set of, you know, all the Curtis photographs. And one is the Smithsonian. And the second is Yale University. And the third is, interestingly, the Dubuque Museum of Art in Dubuque, Iowa.
Hmm.
It was from an early collector. And that we knew that the collection was there. We drove to Dubuque, Iowa, Graham Reed and I. And so we have an exchange relationship with that museum. So we feel very fortunate to be able to exhibit these works.
How do you happen to have, Claire, some of the photos?
Well, I'm an old antiquer from way back when, and my hometown is Baraboo, and the natives, you know, they were just part of the area when I grew up as a kid, but now that I'm older, I really appreciate the whole Native culture so much more and became much more interested in it. And every once in a while, I've run across, the past 10 years or so, every now and then a Curtis photo, and they are quite distinctive.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty easy to spot because of that beautiful sepia toning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they're gorgeous.
Yeah, I think there was one recent, you know, you've got an... It sounds like you've got a nice little stash there. I think there was one of really pristine quality that came up on the auction market in New York, two or three years ago, and it went for well over $1 million.
Oh, my goodness.
So it,
oh, wow.
They are highly prized.
Oh.
Since you mentioned that, Lori, here's another question. How would I know if this is just a print of a print of a print that I have? You know, well, is there a good way to tell?
If you're so inclined, when you visit the Museum of Wisconsin Art, feel free to bring one along, and I'll be happy to take a look at it.
And well, that would be great.
Yeah.
No, that would be great.
We're always happy to do that. And, the condition is always an indicator on value. And, if you have one, I'm a little bit envious. Or if you have a couple, I'm a lot envious.
All right, Claire. Interesting days ahead for you. I feel like we're doing antique roadshows or something on the air. Thanks, Claire, for the call. We should talk a little bit about his Wisconsin ties, which, of course, is one of the reasons you're doing this. Whitewater, he was born near Whitewater.
Whitewater.
And lived in Wisconsin for a while, or did he immediately go to Seattle?
He lived in Wisconsin until he was in his, early teens, and then the entire family moved to Seattle. And it's interesting because he set up a society photograph shop in Seattle and was doing very well, making a lot of money, able to support his family. And in a sense, he gave that all up. At a certain point, he turned the photography shop over to his wife and she ran the business. Eventually, when he was on the road for 30 years, she decided to divorce him. And it's a kind of personal tragedy in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he was just absolutely committed to this vision of preserving Native American culture.
Mm-hmm. Which you are, too. You have said there are other Native American exhibits in the museum right now. You have said that you're establishing the institution, the Museum of Wisconsin Art, to exhibiting and exploring Native American art and its place within the Wisconsin and national art scene.
Right, absolutely. It makes perfect sense. I mean, the museum in its prior form, before we moved into our new building and rebranded and expanded to encompass all of Wisconsin art, had done exhibitions of Native American art, so I don't want this to sound as if this is a first. But when I became the director of the museum, I and the staff and the board talked about it, and we decided that we really wanted to make a commitment to showing the first Native American cultures, the first artistic culture of the state of Wisconsin on a regular basis. There isn't another fine arts museum that is doing that to the degree that we are. We feel that we've made a commitment to this material. And in fact, not only do we have the Edward Curtis show up now, but we also have an exhibition up by a contemporary Madison photographer. He teaches at UW-Madison. His name is Tom Jones. And interestingly, when you talk to Tom Jones, he will say that the most important influence on his career was the work of Edward Curtis 100 years earlier.
Oh, my.
And when you look at Tom Jones' work, you kind of wonder, what is the connection?
Right.
Because he
does
this digital technology, and in fact, he uses toys, this small plastic toys, most often today made in China, of Native American figures and cowboys, and he photographs the bottom of them. And his work is a contemporary commentary on Native American identity in the 21st century. Hmm. And it's a really, really interesting juxtaposition between his work and Edward Curtis.
Do you know what's coming up, what the next exhibit will be, Lori?
We don't, but we are talking about that. We like the idea of celebrating Native American Heritage Month every November, and so certainly we want to do something every year in November that drives home that connection and supports the Native American cultures of Wisconsin.
Let's go to Joan in West Bend. Hi, Joan.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
I'm wonderful, and I just wanted to say that I live in West Bend. I have been to the museum a couple of times. For the people who are listening to the show today, if you haven't been there, you are just missing such an artistic treasure for the state of Wisconsin. And my question to Lori is, and I don't think that this message gets out strong enough or often enough, could you please comment about why Wisconsin art, why a museum dedicated to Wisconsin art is so important to the culture of our state? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Joan.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you, Joan. Thank you for that. I didn't pay Joan to say that, by the way. why Wisconsin art? You know, well, the glib answer is, well, why not? I guess the serious answer is that when you look at the artistic heritage in Wisconsin and you look at what contemporary artists are doing today, you know, it's downright phenomenal. I mean, I look at other states. I have a sense of what's going on in other parts of the U.S. And sure, you can say that New York or, you know, San Francisco have strong artistic cultures. That kind of goes without saying. But when you look at other parts of the country, I mean, Wisconsin is really up there. We are doing some great things. And we have been since, you know, 1820, 1830. There are strong artistic communities in Madison and Milwaukee and Door County, and then spread throughout the entire state. And, you know, I want to give a pat on the back to a lot of artists because, you know, there are artists who choose to live in Wisconsin. They could live anywhere, but they choose to live in Wisconsin because they love the state, they love the culture, and they love the people. And they are recognized on a national and international level. I mean, some of these artists we feature in our permanent collection, and you know, I'll just give a couple of names. Somebody like a Tom Utek, I think, is probably the greatest living American landscape painter today. Hmm. And his works are, you know, in major museums throughout the country. And so here's this guy who lives in, you know, middle Wisconsin. And then somebody like a Therese Agnew, who's probably, you know, the most important textile artist in the United States, if not the most, certainly one of the most important textile artists. So there's a lot to be proud of. And just the kind of imagination, I think maybe it's that pioneer spirit which lingers from the 19th century. So many of our artists are really doing out-of-the-box interesting things. And maybe it's because they're not in New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles. They're not influenced by, you know, what their neighbor's doing or what they think they need to be doing. They're just out there doing great work.
Yeah. That Therese Agnew piece, if you haven't seen that yet, you need to go to the museum to see that as well. That's really a moving piece on so many levels. Anne Makepeace is joining us by phone now to add to our conversation. Her film, Coming to Light, the Edward S. Curtis story, will be shown, as we said, next Thursday, December 5 at 6 o'clock at the museum in conjunction with this Edward S. Curtis exhibit. She is a writer, a producer, and director of award-winning independent films. She's been making films for some 30 years. Her films have been shown on PBS. She's won awards, including the Full Frame Inspiration Award and the Moving Mountains Award at the Telluride Mountain Film Festival for the film most likely to affect important social change. I had a chance to see the film last night and really, really enjoyed it. Anne, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Isn't it nice to know that there's this wonderful display at this beautiful museum and your film is going to be shown? It's just good. It's really good. And the film is so well done. What an interesting man he was, wasn't he?
Yeah, he really was. His life is just amazing.
Yeah. Lori is with us as well, so Lori, feel
free. Hi. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Lori.
Well, it'd be interesting to hear you comment about Edward Curtis and his place in American photography.
Mm. Well, I'm not sure I'm an expert on his place in American photography. I mean, my interest in his work, which is what really comes out in the film, is what do Native Americans think about the work? Mm. You know, when I first became aware of Edward Curtis back, I guess, in the late 70s, I didn't really think about who are these people in the pictures. I was very interested in his life, and which I think has this sort of structure of classic Greek tragedy, which I can elaborate on later if anybody's interested. But as I started to do the film, I became much more interested in how the people who are descended from those he photographed, or in fact, I found a number of people whom he photographed as children. You know, what do they think of the pictures? Because what I was reading in sort of academic articles about Curtis at the time was that it was a lot of negative stuff about him. You know, he posed people, it's all fake. And so when I went out to first the Hopi reservation and then other reservations, and I showed pictures to people there to try to identify who they were and what their stories were and who their families were, the reaction I was getting from the Native people was, well, that's my grandmother.
Yes.
Oh, there she is. She's making tiki, or she's, you know, she's weaving, or whatever. You know, and it was a real eye-opener to see how Native people in, as the film evolved, 10 different reservations all over the West, how they treasured these photographs of their parents, grandparents, and themselves as children.
So why did people become, and who became kind of nitpicky about this? So we put the same shirt on some people. It's obvious by looking at the exhibition that these are striking works. These people are dignified and proud, and they are absolutely gorgeous photos of them that, as you said, are so important to their ancestors. Who complained about it?
Well, there was a lot of attitude in academia about Curtis got himself in trouble even during his lifetime for saying he was both an artist and a scientist.
Oh.
That's where he got in trouble.
Hmm.
He was criticized by, he was never accepted by the Smithsonian. He was criticized by National Geographic Society and by people like Franz Boas, who's, you know, one of the seminal anthropologists in this country. He formed the first anthropology department in the country at Columbia, and sorry, I'm getting distracted a little bit, but at any rate, they said, you know, he fakes things. And the fact is that what I came to understand was that was a really kind of almost racist attitude towards Native Americans. That attitude was, oh, the big bad white guy went in and made the poor, helpless, pathetic Indians do things they didn't want to do. And that is not what happens when you go out to Indian reservations today or then. You know, people participate for their own reasons. And I think people participated in creating the photographs because they were proud, first of all, of their traditional clothes, which they put, you know, as it says in the films, Victorian people put on their best suits. Native people put on their best traditional dress for those photographs. And so, you know, so that was among the things that I learned, that, you know, you have to give Native people agency in this story, that they were collaborating with Curtis for their own reasons to pass down a legacy of their traditions that they also saw were in great jeopardy of disappearing, and in many cases were disappearing because of the forced assimilation policies of our government at the time.
That's the other thing that's striking about this. Lori, let's go to you on this and then back to Anne, that he did capture this moment in time of all of this culture that was disappearing or was about to be, their culture was about to be decimated. There's something striking about knowing that he had little time to get all of these pictures because of the outside forces that were destroying the culture. It kind of, that's something that I thought about every time I saw the pictures, right?
Well, there's one sort of classic episode that's always discussed on this topic of, you know, are they completely truthful photographs? And that's where there was a clock, an alarm clock that was included in one of the original photographs. And he took it out. The photogravure, the final etching, because he felt, I assume, that it didn't reflect the traditional culture, that it was part of the encroachment of white civilization. So he was trying to keep it as accurate as possible. And yet he was criticized for doing that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he had a specific mission, which was to show the beautiful in Indian life, the traditional in Indian life, and that's what he set out to do, and that's what he did. I mean, it's very interesting, you know, some of the things I learned you know, what is going on outside the frame of the picture. You know, I mean, there's a classic Hopi pictures in my film, and the daughter of the person photographed talks about it in the film, and it's a woman making this stuff called piki, kind of a flat blue corn pancake, and she's doing, and her daughter explained to me, well, she's doing that for the tourists. of course, you don't see the tourists in the picture. That would not have been what Curtis would have wanted
right.
to show.
Right.
And that, you know, that she had become a Baptist because there was a famine and the Baptists had food. And that Ethel, the woman who was in her 90s talking about her mother in the picture, you know, was soon sent away to a boarding school where she was forbidden to speak her language. So there's this whole world of really incredible pressure on the people in the pictures to give up their ways, to change their ways. And he saw that, and he wanted to capture that moment while there still were traditional practices
right.
going on. It's really interesting. When you first went out to Hopi, which was maybe a while ago that I did the film, but I think it was 1900, all the girls had what those beautiful butterfly whirls. Their hair,
yeah,
kind of like Princess Leia,
yeah.
in Star
right,
Wars.
Right. Yes.
And when he went, when you know, 6 years later, they almost all had their hair cut off in boarding school. So you know, just within the time frame of him first going there and returning a few years later, those things really were disappearing.
Right.
And you know, that was his mission, to capture that beauty.
Tell us about the part of the film. It's toward the end where he travels with his daughter to this really remote area of Alaska to document Native Americans in Alaska. It's really what a journey fraught with peril. But the photographs that he took are exceptionally beautiful, I think.
Yes, they are really beautiful. And he really focused on children there, which was actually great for me in the film, because I found six people that he had photographed as children who were in their 70s when I got there. So several of them are in the film. But yeah, I mean, that was his last shoot for the North American Indian, his big project. And I think he had, he changed a lot because of all the things he'd gone through, his divorce, and there was a lot of loss in his life, and there's this kind of a humanity and an empathy that is really strong in those later pictures. I think both in the Alaska pictures and also in the pictures he took in California, which are also, you know, kind of later in his career.
You also write about the his divergence in thought. Let's explore this for a moment. That Curtis was thinking as well, that appreciating and documenting this cultural heritage, but also thinking that the Native Americans would be economically destroyed if they did not assimilate. Did he write about that?
Yeah.
What did he say about that?
Well, that's a direct quote that you're referring to, taken from his writings. You know, and he said that, you know, they're going to have to assimilate in order to survive. And he changed his tune on that later in his work, when he saw actually that many aspects of these cultures were surviving, that there was greater resilience than he had imagined at the time that he wrote that. I've forgotten exactly when he wrote the line you're referring to, but it was fairly early in his career. He changed. He came to believe that there were ways to preserve culture and live in the modern world for Native people.
We welcome more phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. We're talking about the Edward S. Curtis exhibit, Well Worth Seeing, which is currently and will be there until January 5 at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. The museum is relatively new as well and definitely worth seeing. Lori Winters is the director of the museum, brought this exhibit to Wisconsin and has a commitment to doing more on a regular basis some of Wisconsin's oldest art, that of Native American tribes. Ann Makepeace is also with us. Her film, which is really so well done, she traveled to all of these places where Curtis had done photographs and interviewed, which is quite a thing to do. Many of the descendants of the people who are pictured in these 45 to 50,000 photos. So her film will be shown. You need to be there next Thursday, December 5 at 6 o'clock in the evening. Coming to Light, the Edward S. Murrow, Edward Murrow is on my mind too. Edward S. Curtis story will be shown at 6 o'clock next week. Phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Those of you who are interested in this hour will be interested in our show next Tuesday at 2 o'clock. We'll be talking with the author of A People's Art History of the United States, 250 Years of Activist Art and Artists Working in Social Justice Movements. Nicholas Lambert, the author, will be with us next Tuesday at 2. And coming up today after 3 on Central Time, Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickert talk to an author about boosting independent booksellers. We have an email here. Let me get this screen where it needs to be. Lori, Jeanette on Facebook says that Curtis was a topic of a research paper from long ago that she had done, and she wonders if there are any buses from Milwaukee to the museum.
Well, that's a very good question.
There should be, by golly.
There should be. Well, I would suggest you email us at wisconsinart.org, and we will get you some information on that.
All right, wisconsinart.org. Yep. All right. Yeah, that would be a good thing to do, wouldn't it? It would be a good thing to do. And, I'm thinking about your journey in putting together this film. You went long distances to document this, didn't you? This was not an easy film to do.
It was a very hard film to do. It took me 10 years to do it.
Did it really?
And
oh, my.
There were, quite a few times when I identified with, some of the things that, some of the obstacles that Curtis had come up against, in my case, in a very small way. But, for example, it was really hard to get to Hopi, right? I had to fly to Phoenix, drive, to Flagstaff, get out to Hopi, and when I thought about it, I thought, well, all right, Curtis had to get there from Seattle before there were airplanes, before there were even trains out there, and it would take him like 10 days to get there, and the last leg of it, which probably took a whole day, was on this wagon going, over sand dunes and gullies and gulches.
Yeah.
And, and also, it took me away from family, and it had some impact on my relationships, and, because I was kind of got obsessed with telling this story. And, so when I think about Curtis's 30-year obsession and complete obsession and complete devotion to this project, I could really relate. And also another parallel was, I would be out, kind of roughing it in Alaska or Montana or Arizona, but roughing it, nowhere near the way he had to rough it. I would stay in a motel generally, not in a tent. And but then, a few weeks later, I'd be back east or, in D.C. trying to get grant money, and that was very similar to Curtis, although Curtis had to go cross country by train to, meet with people, possible funders for his project. So I really did come to identify a lot with some of the difficulties he had in creating the work.
Yeah.
And also another big challenge was winning the trust of Native people to the project, which, he had to do, and which also I had to do, because I'm not Native. I, would arrive. I mean, I had various connections to some of the reservations, but, I had to convince people that this was a thing to participate in, and as did Curtis back in 1900.
Well, and he wanted them to initiate him into the rites of being a snake dancer, right?
At Hopi, yeah, at Hopi.
And right. finally,
and
they
got
said,
quite
"Okay."
A long way in that.
Yeah.
Well, yes and no, but they had their own limits to what they would allow. They taught them the songs. Apparently, they showed them how they tame the snakes, but they did not allow him to participate in the public dancing part of the ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. In a similar way, when I was doing research up on the Pagan Reserve, where I filmed the Sundance. That was the thing that Curtis filmed in 1900 that inspired him to begin this 30-year journey. And I filmed a Sundance in the same place. And when Curtis went, there were certain things they let him film, and there were certain things photographed, and there were certain things they absolutely did not. And those were exactly the same things that I was able to film or not film. Mm-hmm. You know, you could film, you could not really film the ceremony. You could film the brave dogs, who are those riders carrying in the rushes. You know, he photographed them in 1900. I was able to film that in 1998, I think, was when I was filming that. So it's very interesting to see how the traditions hold and what is allowed and what is not allowed and the protocols that survived for 100 years.
Yeah. Let's go to Judy in Bayside. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I did see the exhibit. I thought it was just marvelous. And I wanted to know if you can't be available on December 5th, is there another showing of this film? Because that sounds like such a good supplement to this exhibit.
You can, I believe, purchase the film. And maybe Anne can tell you about that.
Yeah, if you go to my website, which is www.makepeaceproductions.com, Makepeace being my last name, you will find links to where you can actually purchase a DVD. There are other ways to see it digitally, if you're into that. So I don't really want to say that because I want people to go to the showing. But I guess if you can't, there are other ways to see it. And if you can't figure it out, email me through my website and I'll help you out.
Or we could tell you next Thursday after the showing.
There we go.
The way that I saw the film. Right. Judy,
right.
Thanks very much for the call. Rose in Chatville. Hi.
Hark to the Irish Lark, Kathleen. I happened to be in Custer. It was at least 8 or 9 years ago. I'd never been there before. And it was, you know, home to 700 nations there. And they were in the process of sculpting Crazy Horse. And one of the members of the family was there. And I said to her, has anyone famous been here? And she said, yes. President Clinton was here. And she said he went downstairs and he knew all 100 names of all of those Curtis photographs.
Oh,
that's interesting.
And then the... photograph you, or that's in the Easter parade. You know, I could write a sonnet, and then photographer will take us, and you'll find that you're in the photograph you.
Yes, yeah. I remember that too. Thank you for reminding me that where it came from.
So that's really all, and it's always great to hear your show, Kathleen.
Thank you, Rose. Thanks very much for the call, Lori. Are you familiar did you know that Clinton was a big fan of his work?
No, I didn't. I did know that Ralph Lauren, the designer, is a big fan and has a pretty large collection of his work. But I didn't know about Bill Clinton. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it is. And that's a we're almost out of time. I'm having such a good time. Can you do this in 40 seconds? Let me ask. You were talking about the similarities in your stories are amazing. The driving force. There's something that drove you because this wasn't an easy film. You know, underneath everything, something that drove you, something that drove Curtis at great sacrifice to do what he did. Were they the same? What were they? Just briefly, Anne.
Yeah, that's a tough one in 40 seconds.
Sorry.
I think what happens with me in a film is I fall in love. And it's interesting that on this film, I fell in love first with Curtis and then with the native people that he photographed.
Oh,
but it's
interesting.
That, it's that passion that drives you. And I fell in love with him first because of his his sacrifice, his passion, his commitment, his single-mindedness. I guess I related to that.
Mm-hmm.
But then, as I say, I shifted to being more interested in what the photographs meant to the Native people of it.
Yeah, which made the film. Thank you, Anne Makepeace. Thank you, Anne. Laurie, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For being with us. See the exhibit. It's at the Museum of Wisconsin Art until January 5. The film will be shown next Thursday night at 6 o'clock, but you can see the exhibit anytime you want to. Thanks to KP Whaley and Lisa Nalbany for producing.